It's a pleasure to be here. This is my first visit to Deep Wireless, but of course I've known about this month-long celebration of radio and the Radio Without Boundaries conference for years. I'm here to talk about the foundations of transmission art, and I want to first, as I was just chatting with Chris about a little bit, sort of qualify this with, I'm interested in starting a conversation, continuing a conversation about the genre and telling you about the work that we've been doing to help cultivate it. This is not a definitive assertion, and it is a subjective take on definitions and work that falls under the transmission art umbrella. So I look forward to the next 2 days being an opportunity to continue and expand these conversations. Free 103.9, where I serve as executive director, is celebrating its 15th year anniversary this year. And throughout the last 15 years, the organization has been focused on this idea of defining and cultivating transmission arts, artists who are working, making work with, for, and about the transmission spectrum in its most simplest terms. So contemporary transmission art is united by a spirit of experimentation and innovation. Transmission artists find their audiences in galleries, museums, public and private space, in educational contexts. Audiences take the form of listeners, viewers, readers, participants, and students. Transmission projects defy exclusive classification. They take shape as sound artworks and are presented as composition or live performance. They sometimes appear as moving image works transmitted as television, broadcast, or video art. They may appear in installations that draw from the transmission spectrum, perhaps sampling multiple radio or scanner feeds, or adding to what is on air by creating site-specific radio stations inside a gallery or a public space. In addition, reproducible multiples or distributed objects share technology and access in the form of transmission toolkits, while radio theater works engage radio space as a stage for storytelling. Interventionist acts intentionally blur the lines between art and activism. Mobile artworks repurpose ubiquitous wireless consumer technologies for creative means. Regardless of a bewildering variety of approaches, transmission art projects all celebrate the imaginative use of tools of communication. And there is also a conversation to have around terminology. There are those that love the term transmission used in this context and those who find it really problematic. Anna Friz, who is a familiar name to this conference, makes an argument for transception as an alternative term. She's interested in, my understanding, of really foregrounding two-way participation, transmitter and receiver, and feels that transmission does this better. But the act of transmission, taken literally as the wireless sending and receiving of electric signals by means of electromagnetic waves, is, of course, handles this two-way idea. And it's also interchangeable with the term, the true definition of radio. But radio art, we feel, denotes works conceived for FM broadcast specifically. And it's my position that while radio artworks play an important role in the history of transmission art, it is not a comprehensive one. So we'll talk more at lunch about these ideas. I know Victoria has something to say in this regard. So let's start a little bit with Free 103.9's own 15-year history, and this will guide us through some recent projects, artists, and works, and then we'll jump farther back to trace a trajectory of inventors, experimenters, and organizations contributing to the formation of the genre, at least in my eyes. So Free 103.9, good, that's working. Some of these are going to have legible text and some not, so bear with me, was established, as I said, 15 years ago in 1997. Originally, it was a micro radio collective based in Brooklyn, New York. This is a flyer from our very first microcast. The founders of Free 103.9 were then journalist and DJ Tom Rowe, who's in Toronto this weekend and who hopefully you all have the chance to meet if you haven't already, and Greg Anderson, who is a drummer, and visual artist Violet Hopkins. These three were among thousands of participants in the U.S. micro radio movement. And as I'm sure this audience knows, the term micro radio became widely used in the mid-90s when media activists performed acts of civil disobedience by broadcasting without a license to demonstrate the importance of making low-power FM radio available to communities as an alternative to corporate monopoly of the airwaves. concurrent with the movement's relative success in terms of lobbying for the licensing of low-power FM, or LPFM, in 2000, Free 103.9 witnessed members of its community of micro-radio broadcasters who took the shape then mostly of noise and free jazz musicians, poets, sound and visual artists, shift their practice with micro-power broadcast from simply a means of distribution to creating conceptually driven, sometimes rigorous, transmission-based projects utilizing the electromagnetic spectrum as an artistic medium. I entered the picture in the year 2000 after meeting Tom Rowe, who I mentioned before, who Tom and I are married, I should mention. And in 2002, Free 103.9 transitioned into a nonprofit organization focused on cultivating and defining a new genre, transmission arts. So in order to cultivate and define the genre, Free 103.9 ran a small, somewhat underground venue in Brooklyn, New York, which we called the Free 103.9 Gallery and Project Space. This is just a montage of images from that space. It was in South Williamsburg. The project space not only served as a place for experimentation for those artists who were starting to self-identify as transmission art practitioners, but it also continued to serve the experimental music scene in Brooklyn. Participating noise and free jazz musicians were tasked with confronting a micro-radio or transmission component in the conception of their performances. This strategy seduced many into truly considering and engaging the electromagnetic spectrum. In some cases, for the first time, artists started incorporating shortwave, walkie-talkies, homemade transmitters, both audio and video, 2.4 gigahertz technology, and more into their works. Simultaneously, we established several large-scale transmission arts projects, and these projects were, at their essence, expanded micro-radio frameworks, which included a rotating cast of artists. Here, artists whose work may have primarily been based in experimental sound or moving image practices found themselves working with transmission media and concepts. Most of these artists would then start to include transmission art ideas and technology in their future work. So these initial touring project frameworks I'm referring to include Tune In, Tune Outside, Radio 4x4, and Micro Radio Soundwalk, and I'll describe each of these just briefly for you. Premiering in early 2003 at the New York Center for Media Arts in Long Island City, New York, Tune-ins are sound events designed for a virtually silent environment in which listeners experience simultaneous live performances in individual radio headsets as opposed to amplified within a performance space. As many as 6 individual micro radio stations and up to 60 performing artists are set up within an event space. Each station microcasts on a unique frequency. Participants are provided with a detailed schedule. You're looking at on this side, the schedule from our first ever Tune-In. And then the image over there is the cover of a program notes from Tune in the Kitchen the following year. So the schedule outlines the multiple frequencies to tune into, as well as the live performances taking place on each station. In order to access the performances, listeners must engage and consider the radio spectrum, traversing the dial to the tune-in FM frequencies, encountering other commercial stations available in between those tune-in frequencies as they turn the dial, or the minimal ambient room noise. Artists and audience relationships are challenged in this simultaneously isolating yet communal space. 2 friends who attend the event together might stand closely together, but are likely experiencing 2 completely different performances. A performing artist might have a crowd of attentive listeners assembled in front of him or her, but can't know for sure which performance their audience is actually listening to. Our second tune-in, as I mentioned, was presented at The Kitchen in New York in conjunction with the citywide festival New Sound New York in 2004. Subsequent tune-ins and tune-outsides, tune-outside is an outdoor version of a tune-in, have been presented at the Center for Contemporary Art in Santa Fe. We did one at the Brooklyn Project Space and at Wave Farm in New York's Hudson Valley. In Radio 4x4, which was conceived also in 2003, 4 simultaneous performances are separately sent through FM transmitters to radios, often boomboxes, positioned throughout a performance space. Each radio receives 1 of the signals. The audience is instructed to move about the space, creating their own mix of the audio feeds determined by their movement in the space among the 4 signals. Radio 4x4s have been presented dozens of times with many, many different artists. This is program note and some blurry images from Radio 4x4 at the Guggenheim in New York. You did one at the Philadelphia ICA, the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, Mattress Factory in Pittsburgh, also in Poland and South Korea, among other places. So this is a easier to travel project and a way to really work with a wide scope of artists. Typically when we travel, we bring two Free 103.9 related artists from New York and then invite two local artists from wherever we're doing the project. Okay, so this is a micro radio sound walk. It was conceived in 2004, originally for Spectropolis, which was a project of the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, which examined the expanding use of wireless technologies in urban environments, underscoring their implications for art, aesthetic play, community, and shared space. In micro radio sound walk, three radio stations are set up. They're microcasting on the same frequency and set up along a designated path. Each station is given a thematic focus. One is social spaces, one is local frequencies, and environmental surroundings. And audience members are provided with radio receivers tuned to the appropriate frequency and headphones. They proceed on a walking route, and participants hear the performance happening at the station they're in closest proximity to. As they walk out of range from the first station and proceed to the next, moving from signal to signal, the changing soundscape reflects an invisible architecture and sonic phenomena of transmission space. Micro radio sound walks have taken place at the Warsaw CCA in Poland, which is, you're seeing a completely illegible part at front of the poster. That was the program notes for that event. We also did one in Hall Walls in Buffalo, at the Ingenuity Festival in Cleveland, among other places. In that same year, 2004, we decided to expand north. Free 103.9 program director Tom Rowe and I relocated our personal residence from Brooklyn to rural upstate New York, about 2 hours north of the city, and we secured approximately 30 acres of land that we named Wave Farm. Programs envisioned for Wave Farm included an outdoor summer performance series, Transmission Arts Sculpture Park, an artist residency program that would both continue to cultivate the genre and provide artists with unique access to space, both in terms of the physical landscape and the transmission spectrum. Most of our visiting artists would come from urban centers where both land and spectrum real estate is difficult to come by. As we worked to get programs underway at Wave Farm, we kept up with a lively roster of things in the city. On the Air was conceived on the occasion of the first Performa Biennial for Performance Art in New York in 2005. This architecture in motion for the reception of polyphonic radio signals was a 4-day installation at the White Box Gallery in Chelsea. On the Air used the Radio 4x4 framework as a springboard, but here small radio receivers were attached to helium balloon clusters. And each morning, the balloons and radios which dangled from them would start on the ceiling of the exhibition space. And then as the day progressed, the balloons began to fall and moved quite a lot, actually, as they lost their helium around the space. Each day featured interventions in the space from a roster of over a dozen artists. On the Air was equally visual and aural. Free 103.9 programs have regularly featured transmission artworks that are made manifest in installation or sculpture to help demonstrate that transmission arts is truly multidisciplinary. We don't simply mean radio in terms of FM broadcast, and we also don't just mean sound art or performance. As part of this effort, Free 103.9 has frequently commissioned new installation-based works and web-based projects in collaboration with institutional partners. Excuse me. As part of the New Museum for Contemporary Art's transmission series, the exhibition Airborne in 2005 profiled new projects by New York-based artists who investigate aesthetic, sonic, and socio-political aspects of the wireless spectrum. I'll take a sip of water. Selected from an open call, artists 31 Down, Paul Davies, Melissa Dubin and Aaron Davidson, Tariq Kurula, Lovid, Neurotransmitter, and Mendy and Keith Obadike exposed otherwise fleeting and invisible transmissions through conceptual projects, networked installations, live streams, audio, and visual works. And I'll discuss just a few of those. in Wonderlost, 31 Down considers personal privacy issues and the paranoia surrounding new technologies by eavesdropping on live police scans to search for clues in the world of the dispatcher. Employing the central motif of a 1940s style detective radio program featuring the fictional case of missing nightclub singer Helen Trumbull, Wanderlust creates a tension between fact and fiction. A visitor sits down, puts the headphones on to experience the piece, and the radio play's playback system is tied to a live police scanner. When there's activity on the scanner, the scanner plays and the radio play pauses. So there's this constant site-specific and live personality to the work where real and fabricated crimes stories are interwoven. In a twofold project titled Last and Lost Transmissions, collaborating artists Melissa Dubin and Aaron S. Davidson focus on lost and found messages. In Last Transmissions, the artists rebroadcast an amalgam of final messages made by individuals, a disc jockey signing off one last time, or a lost sailor's plea, creating an opening into divergent narratives. In Lost Transmissions, the artists collect and rebroadcast radio messages that have been lost during the process of transmission. Davidson and Dubin offered these messages a chance to be found by devoting a small temporary radio station in the museum space to their retransmission. Exploiting the techniques of current commercial radio practice, Chop 10 by Tariq Karula remixes a live dynamic assemblage of commercial radio streams as a commentary on the current state of regulated radio. As his work Chop 10 moves from one Arbitron-rated top 10 radio station in New York City to the next, a hyperscan makes it impossible to discern any single station's content, at least for very long, resulting in a jumpy, never-ending parody of commercial radio. And I'm just going to play a little bit of this for you. In Ether Fairy, Lovid manipulates a signal breakdown and establishes a tactile relationship with technology. Ether Fairy features a live video feed generated by an electrical signal, simultaneously broadcast between multiple video transmitters and receivers. The video signal is pure feedback of raw electrical signal through transmitters and receivers, vintage analog video mixers and processors. In the installation, video transmitters and receivers are placed in two sliding boxes. Visitors are able to slide the boxes and change the levels of mixing and decay between the signals. The change in the relative locations of the transmitters and receivers affects the resulting video produced by the system. The sliding boxes and the plasma screen are covered with handmade fabric patchwork. The patchworks are created from video stills printed on fabric. And the video stills are screen captures from a video recorded with the Ether Fairy system before the exhibition. The video-generated fabric is an example of Lovid's explorations of the translation and preservation of signals. By printing the video on fabric and bringing the fabric back into the installation, the artist draws visitors into a tactile, hands-on interaction with technology. Sorry, my voice is going. We'll see what happens. Twelve Miles Out is a visual and sound installation that merges analog radio transmission with line drawing. Specifically referencing Radio Caroline, this work continues our exploration of offshore pirate radio practices prevalent in the 1960s and 70s. Install the drawing as antenna represents a blueprint of one of the fleet of Radio Caroline's ships. A sound collage created from archived broadcasts of Radio Caroline and sound recordings of a voyage taken out to sea is transmitted through the antenna drawing and received by radios placed within the exhibition environment. So here the drawing is literally serving as the antenna in the space. In 2006, Free 103.9 and the acclaimed new media organization Rhizome announced an open call in conjunction with an online exhibition of web-based projects. The exhibition Surge included works by artists 31 Down, Abe Lincoln, and Marissa Olson, Angel Navarez, and Alex Rivera, New York Society for Acoustic Ecology, Jim Punk, and Leslie Sharp. The featured projects employed new media tools, both conceptually and formally, addressing different possibilities for transmission art online. Some consider the nature of signals as they move through the ether. Others appropriate forms of wireless transmission, such as the military's aerial drone or the programming language ASCII, to propose new kinds of digital communication. This project was, I think, very intentionally looking to address this question of art online and what is transmission art and what isn't within that context. So 2007 marked Free 103.9's 10th anniversary season. It was a year of expansion again. Lots of many projects, both in New York City and upstate. The image on over there, the image on my right, is from an event we did at Wave Farm called Spectral Garden. I think that's Matthew Bertner doing a transmitter piece, and we had Nick Collins and I think Scanner for that event. And this is just the 10th anniversary program we produced that year. We did a really fun project with 31 Down that took place in the Canal Street subway system. Max Goldfarb did a QSL artist's object series. But I realize you can't actually see this text, so I'm gonna run through it kind of quickly. So that same year in 2007, in that fall, we took another big leap. The Federal Communications Commission in the US opened a rare application window for new non-commercial full-power FM stations. For the next several years, Free 103.9's focus turned to applying for and then creating the radio station WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC was conceived both as a community media project as well as one that would dedicate considerable time to the experimental, in a way that no other station, at least to our knowledge, did or does in the US. WGXC went on air February 2011. It serves a potential 80,000 listeners with 24-hour programming 7 days a week, and approximately 60 hours a week on WGXC are devoted to transmission arts and experimental sound programming. We operate out of three studios. Let me jump back for a second. As noted on the map. This is our Hudson studio, and we figured Gregory Whitehead isn't here this weekend, so we'll bring him here this way. He did a really great four-hour broadcast for us back in April of 2011. This is our Catskill studio. It's on Main Street, and it's in a storefront window. The image on my right is the storefront, and this was well before we had gotten on the air and we were just trying to cultivate public interest. And then the image on my left is from the launch event for the FM station. We were only operating out of the Hudson studio at that point, and an artist named Matt Bua and a lot of local kids came together and sort of made a cardboard version, envisioning of what the studio would be. And the console there actually has little cardboard faders that you can move up and down, and it was very sweet. And the Catskill studio is now operational, but in sort of a DIY mode. So the third studio is at Wave Farm and located in the very recently completed Wave Farm Study Center, which is pictured here. This building was first conceived in 2006, and a conversation for lunch or dinner is a very entertaining story about the extended construction timeline. But it's just been completed, and we expect the facility to be opening very, very, very soon. The Study Center houses our Artist in Residency program, providing work and presentation space, in addition to the Acre-based WGXE studio. And the Study Center also features a library, reading and listening, focused on transmission arts, media art history, and experimental sound and music. It's this library and archive component that I am particularly excited by and committed to, and I believe through these kinds of resources that that 3103.9 best can serve our mission to define and cultivate the transmission art genre. Answering the question, what is transmission arts, or what are the foundations, has been a constant refrain throughout our organization's history. And this brings me to talk a little bit about the book we published last year with PIJ Publications called Transmission Arts, Artists and Airwaves. So the book project was actually first initiated back in 2003. Free 103.9 staff members at that time, Tiana Kennedy, Sarah Lippick, Matt Mikus, and Tom Rowe and I worked together drafting an outline for a book that would define the genre, cite early experiments, celebrate the micro-radio movement, and identify contemporary practitioners working within an arts context. However, we were then a newly formed nonprofit, and establishing and executing our programs meant our efforts towards the book didn't move much beyond early research and the project outline. Years later, the book idea was revisited with some certainty thanks to the collaboration of my co-authors, Penny Duff and Maria Papadomenalaki, and the commitment of PIJ Publications as publisher, which was a big coup for us. This time, our intentions focused on publishing a resource that would establish a genealogy for the genre by presenting 150 representative artists and works. The citation of these 150 artists would provide a foundation for an expansive transmission arts online archive, and we hoped would inform future scholarly work on the genre. Okay, so the images you're going to be looking at now are illustrations included in the book, and unfortunately, time constraints prevented me from adding captions to these. There's a lot of them, but they are identified in the book, so you can find me later if any of them grab you and you must know what the title of that work is. So I'm just going to let the slideshow run so you can have something else to gaze upon besides my talking head. So like the works encompassed by the genre, transmission arts lineage is anything but linear. Transmission art practitioners demonstrate an interest in an expansive idea of radio and often pursue its demystification and innovation through a do-it-yourself, hands-on relationship with transmission technology, paying homage to the inventors who are making large, often simultaneous strides in wireless technologies in the mid and late 19th centuries. So who are the key inventors to cite in this discussion of foundations and or origin? There are the obvious bright spots and those who are less recognized. The following that I'll mention is a short list of 8 innovators born in the 19th century whose work, I believe, has made critical contributions to the transmission arts genre. Born 1815, Abbé Giovanni Caselli was an Italian physicist and the inventor of the first fax machine prototype. Caselli began to research different ways of perfecting the transmission of images using telegraphic technology when he was a professor of physics at the University of Florence in 1860. At Florence. In 1860, Caselli presented the first almost complete pen telegraph. Caselli's invention caught the attention of Emperor Napoleon III, who facilitated Caselli's experiments, providing access to the region's telegraphic lines. In November 1860, a telegraphic line was assigned to Caselli for the realization of an inner-city transmission between Paris and Amiens. Caselli's experiment was a resounding success, in part thanks to his set of synchronization timers immune to the changes in the electrical current of the telegraphic wire, and the first pen telegraph was officially registered in 1861. Serbian inventor Nikola Tesla, born in 1856, is of course well recognized for his strides in electricity and electromagnetism. In 1894, he wirelessly lit up a single terminal incandescent lamp in New York, and in 1896, he successfully demonstrated wireless communication through radio. His electrical work in the late 1800s developed alternating current, AC electrical power, which formed the basis for modern electricity. In what was referred to as the War of the Currents, Thomas Edison was at odds with George Westinghouse, which was Tesla's employer, regarding the preferable means for electrical power distribution. Edison advocated for direct current, DC, rather than Tesla's alternating current, AC. Tesla proposed his system for the transmission of electrical energy without wires, dependent upon the Earth's conductivity, as early as 1904 in his essay published in the periodical Electrical World and Engineer. Charles Jenkins, born 1867, was an early cinema pioneer who created a projector he called the phantoscope. Jenkins is also among the innovators credited with developing television. In general, Jenkins used mechanical rather than electronic technologies. His article Motion Pictures by Wireless was published in Motion Picture News in 1913, and in 1923, Jenkins demonstrated transmitting moving silhouette images. It was not until 3 years later that he formally presented a synchronized transmission of pictures and sound and secured the related patent. In 1928, the Jenkins Television Corporation launched the first television broadcasting station in the US, W3XK. Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi, born 1874, is responsible for numerous improvements to the wireless telegraph device, to the devices developed by earlier inventors such as Hertz, Popov, Brantley, Tesla, and Lodge. More notably, Marconi plays a major role in the lively discussion around origins of radio transmission and related patents, which has been a topic of controversy in the courts and recorded history for well over a century. While the success in terms of transmitted content received is in dispute, is not also without controversy, his transatlantic transmission experiments in the early 1900s are indisputable documented events. On December 12, 1901, Marconi's first radio signal was transmitted across the Atlantic from Cornwall, England, to Signal Hill at St. John's, Newfoundland. Responsible for over 180 patents in his lifetime, Lee DeForest, born 1873, is widely regarded for his innovations and improvements to the vacuum tube used early in radio and television. In 1906, DeForest's Audion added elements of control and amplification to earlier vacuum tubes developed by Thomas Edison and Ambrose Fleming. DeForest's Audion detected radio signals and converted radio frequency into audio frequency ready for amplification. Born in 1874, Frank Conrad worked for Westinghouse Electric Company in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Originating from a Westinghouse building with his own garage as backup service, Conrad launched the first licensed broadcast station in the world, KDKA 1020 AM, November 1920. And born 1888, John Logie Baird was a Scottish engineer and inventor of many successful electronic systems for grayscale and color moving image broadcast, which would later be called television. Baird publicly demonstrated the product of his first experiments, the scanning disc or the Nipkow disc, from his London laboratory, January 1926. 1 year later, he successfully transmitted the first long-distance television signal between London and Glasgow. This demonstration was followed shortly thereafter by the first transatlantic television broadcast between London and New York. In 1939, he produced the first experiment with color television by installing revolving color filters in front of a cathode ray tube. He publicly demonstrated the first electronic color TV in 1941, and the system employed a 600-line color patent. Baird planned to improve the system by increasing the resolution to 1,000 lines, making it almost comparable to contemporary high-definition television. In addition to his television innovations, he also contributed to the development of fiber optics, infrared night vision, and radar technologies. Finally, born in 1890 in New York, Edwin Howard Armstrong was an American electrical engineer and the inventor of frequency modulation radio. While studying at Columbia University, he invented the regenerative circuit, which he patented as wireless receiving system in 1914. The patent was claimed by Lee DeForest and sold to AT&T, spurring a lengthy series of lawsuits over radio patent ownership. 12 years of legal dispute followed, and though Armstrong won an initial round in the courts, he eventually lost the case, and the patent was granted to DeForest. While in the midst of this legal struggle, Armstrong began a series of experiments that led to the creation of a wideband frequency modulator in 1933. These efforts resulted in what is commonly known today as FM radio. In support of his discovery, Armstrong conducted a number of large-scale FM test transmissions from the Empire State Building in New York. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission resisted Armstrong's inventions and innovations, articulating an allegiance to the then dominant AM radio technology. Armstrong's FM patent was claimed by RCA, and once again, Armstrong found himself entrenched in legal battles. Following his death, his position was ultimately vindicated, though, through a court victory obtained by his widow. So where do these inventions leave us and lead us? Inventors of transmission technologies were innovators and experimenters. Some say they were consumed by ideas of what a future society, empowered by their tools, could achieve. In the early decades of the 20th century, works created under the artistic and social umbrella of futurism celebrated noise, speed, and experimentation. Improvisation with and about machinery and technology were commonly explored. Rousselot's Futurist Manifesto, The Art of Noise, of 1913, classified noise sound into six discrete groupings, including thunderings, whistlings, murmurings, rustlings, percussion with common objects, and vocal noise produced by people and animals. And 8 years later, Velimir Klebnikov's manifesto, The Radio of the Future, prophesized an evolution of the medium where text, images, scents, and even flavors could be communicated through broadcast. In what is perhaps the first articulated conception of transmission art, Klebnikov also envisioned a future where radio would emit ethereal art exhibitions. So artists Brian Dewan and Max Goldfarb produced an interpretation of Klebnikov's The Radio of the Future on the occasion of WGXC's first pledge drive back in April of 2011 for the Saturday Transmission Arts programming. And I thought it might be good to listen to a little bit of it now. Wait a minute. Let's try and get it back in the beginning. There we go.
The radio of the future. The radio of the future, the central tree of our consciousness, will inaugurate new ways to cope with our endless undertakings and will unite all mankind. The main radio station, the stronghold of steel, where clouds of wires cluster like strands of hair, will surely be protected by a sign with a skull and crossbones and the familiar word, danger, since the least disruption of radio operations would produce a mental blackout over the entire country, a temporary loss of consciousness. Radio is becoming the spiritual son of the country, a great wizard and sorcerer. Let us try to imagine radio's main station in the air a spider's web of lines, a storm cloud of lightning bolts, some subsiding, some flaring up anew, crisscrossing the building from one end to the other. A bright blue ball of spherical light hanging in midair like a timid bird, guy wires stretched out at a slant. From this point on planet Earth, every day, like the flight of birds in springtime, a flock of news departs, news from the life of the spirit. In this stream of lightning birds, the spirit will prevail over force, good counsel over threats. The activities of artists who work with the pen and brush, the discoveries of artists who work with ideas, McNichol, Einstein, will instantly transport mankind to unknown shores. Advice on day-to-day matters will alternate with lectures by those who dwell upon the snowy heights of the human spirit. The crests of waves in the sea of knowledge will roll across the entire country into each local radio station to be projected the very day as letters onto the dark pages of enormous books, higher than houses, that stand in the center of each town, slowly turning their own pages.
Radio reading walls. These books of the streets will be known as radio reading walls. The giant dimensions frame the settlements and carry out the task of all mankind. Radio has solved the problem that the church itself was unable to solve, and has thus become as necessary to each settlement as a school is, or a library. The problem of celebrating the communion of humanity's one soul, one daily spiritual wave that washes over the entire country every 24 hours, saturating it with a flood of scientific and artistic news, that problem has been solved by radio using lightning as its tool. On the great illuminated books in each town, Radio Today has printed a story by a favorite writer, an essay on the fractional exponents of space, a description of airplane flights, and news about neighboring countries. Everyone can read whatever he chooses. This one book, identical across the entire country, stands in the center of every small town, always surrounded by a ring of readers, a carefully composed silent reading wall in every settlement. But now in black type, news of an enormous scientific discovery appears on the screens. A certain chemist, famous within the narrow circle of his followers, has discovered a method for producing meat and bread out of...
So, I'll stop there looking at the time, knowing that we need to run on schedule. But it's a really nice interpretation of the text, and it's available on the Transmission Art Archive if anyone wants to hear it in its entirety. So similarly, oh my goodness, interested in the synesthetic possibilities of radio, the first Hörspiel was broadcast in Germany in 1924. Translated literally as radio play, Hörspiel uses sound effects, music, and dialogue to embolden the imagination of its listeners. Both an ironic and self-reflective exercise, Hans Fleisch's Zauberei auf dem Sender, Radio Magic, describes a radio station's struggle to present a program on the air through a compendium of dialogue, noise, and experimental music. It seems Hörspiel was slow to be embraced in the US. In the mid-1980s, FM stations KPFA, the country's first community-supported radio station in Berkeley, and VDR in Cologne united with assistance from the Goethe Institute in San Francisco to produce Hörspiel USA, a series of 9 programs presenting 12 Hörspiele never before heard in the US. The series demonstrated a broad definition of radio theater that encompasses works situated within traditional definitions of theater, as well as theatrical works driven by poetics, performance, and sound art. In 1935, the German electronics company AEG unveiled the first audio tape recorder at the Berlin Radio Show, an international radio exhibition occurring regularly since 1926. This device would make a considerable impact on electronic music, placing new tools in the hands of musicians, composers, and engineers. After World War II, artists began using the tape recorder to produce works that employed a new method of composition called musique concrète. Pierre Schaeffer, the French musician and theorist, popularized this technique in 1948 in Paris with his 5 Studies of Noises, a series composed solely for tape. And in the years following, works by Karlheinz Stockhausen and John Cage, among others, pioneered the use of real-time media, including radio, as a viable instrument in composition and performance. Cage's work in particular, which privileged chance operation and non-musical instrumentation and conceptually driven composition over musical aptitude, serves as a primary influence on many of the contemporary works cited in the book. Cage's experimental composition classes at the New School for Social Research in New York City from 1957 to 59 served as fertile ground for the convergence of early practitioners of the avant-garde, including Jackson McLaugh, George Brecht, Dick Higgins, and Alan Kaprow. Lithuanian-born artist George Mačiūnas, who was also at the New School, became a propelling force of Fluxus as a movement rejecting intellectualism and artificial art in order to promote living art and anti-art and to elevate the ordinary. In a resounding illustration of these priorities, transmission works often embrace live, ordinary media in order to reveal a present moment in time without being beholden to a specific location or instance. For example, in Keith Sonnier's Scanners, Quad Scan, a series of radio scanners are installed in an exhibition space and tuned to emergency frequencies. The transmissions received in this work's first installation in 1975 vary considerably from installations in recent years, and in each instance, the installation takes on a new and prescient social awareness and critique. In an explicit act of social engagement occurring with the anti-war movement in the US in the late 1960s and early 1970s, artists gained access to portable video equipment. Sony's Portapak, the first portable half-inch video recording system, became commercially available in 1967. Often working as collectives, video artists saw a radical opportunity in transmission media as a tool that might at long last realize democratic, cultural, and global communication networks. Collectives like Top Value Television, TVTV, and the Video Freaks produced subversive works that challenged corporate media and exposed a corrupt political system. In the 1980s, global communication experiments connected a broad network of international video artists. Satellite and other telecommunication technologies promised new possibilities of live and remote collaboration. In recent years, the ubiquity of wireless devices tied to the internet have once again inspired artists interested in communication networks. And in a consistent thread, independent and community media is revered as a means to combat a dystopian political, social, and creative climate. An investment in public access to the transmission spectrum is intrinsic to the engagement of the airwaves for artistic purpose. Transmission art often emerges from an interest in spectrum regulation and a critique of the limited public access that exists for experimentation with electronic communication. Not surprisingly, then, transmission artists have deep roots in media activism and share concerns regarding corporate control of the airwaves. Excuse me. Individuals and efforts to mention in a short list of activism contributing to transmission arts genealogy include Mambana Kantaka from Springfield, Illinois. And I'm going to kind of speed through this because we're getting close to my end time. Free Radio Berkeley, Steal This Radio, Radio Mutiny, which became Prometheus Radio Project. Communications technology and activism working together to ensure public and artistic access to the transmission spectrum provide the foundation from which the transmission art genre emerges. Like the works encompassed by the genre, transmission art's lineage is anything but linear. And as just outlined, inventors were making large, often simultaneous strides in wireless technologies. And over 100 years later, the micro radio movement of the 1990s empowered a wave of radio practitioners and activists dedicated to a specific cause, providing the public with licensed access to their own airwaves. In the arts, organizations' work fostered the emerging genre of transmission art within a contemporary art and cultural context. I've used Free 103.9's history throughout much of this talk, but there are other organizations whose activities have been equally, if not more, influential. In 1967, launched by Billy Kluver, Fred Waldhauer, and Robert Rauschenberg, and Robert Whitman, EAT, their efforts were aimed at connecting engineers to work with artists. Their legendary Nine Evenings, Theater and Engineering, held at the 69th Regiment Armory in New York, succeeded in broadening the artist's role in mainstream contemporary society and aided in the integration of artistic practices and emerging technologies. In 1974, ZBS Media, an innovative radio production company, established the ZBS Air Program in Fort Edward, New York, not that far from Wave Farm. Air provided audio facilities, personnel, and services to artists working with electronic media. Originally designed as a residency program, Air quickly became a networking resource as well as a focal point for the production and distribution of a wide range of transmission art. Founded in 87, Kunstradio, of course, is conceived as a space for radio art, an art that reflects the radio medium itself. Their weekly program almost immediately broadened its mission, serving as a point of access for international visual artists, media artists, composers, and writers. The Center for New Media Culture, RIXC, is a multidisciplinary media arts center in Riga, Latvia. Their annual festival, Art Plus Communication, was established in 1996. And for several years, they focused on ideas intrinsic to the transmission art genre. Waves was 2006, Spectral Ecology 2007, Spectropia 2008, and Energy 2009. And of course, Resonance FM needs to be mentioned. founded in 2002 by London Musicians Collective. Resonance is a station with an exemplary commitment to creative radio, intent on securing space for artworks that have no place in traditional broadcasting. They consider themselves an invisible gallery, a virtual art center whose location is at once local, global, and timeless. The Radia Network, founded in 2005, is a group of international independent radio projects that share a commitment to radio as an art form. They're united in a goal to foster an audio space where something different can happen. And as everybody likely knows, it's a pretty broad geographical expanse here. Stations, participants are located in Belgium, Canada, Germany, the US, Austria, France, New Zealand, Italy, UK, Portugal, Czech Republic, Hungary, and the Netherlands. Radius is a relatively recent project out of Chicago. They feature a new project semi-monthly with statements by artists who use radio as a primary element in their work. Radius provides artists with live and experimental formats in radio programming, and their work is their goal is to support work that engages the tonal and public spaces of the electromagnetic spectrum. And fitting then to end the talk with a big nod and a bow to Desa, our host, New Adventures in Sound Art, founded in 2003, of course producing performances and installations that expand the entire spectrum of electroacoustic and experimental sound art, and the Deep Wireless Festival, of course, being acclaimed month-long celebration of radio and transmission art. This weekend, the papers presented, the performances, the workshops, I hope will make a significant impact on the dialogue around transmission arts, and I'm so looking forward to the next 2 days to see what we learn and what we're taught. Thanks.